The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing, interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy, because being human is the common denominator for us all. So, welcome to Secure in Mind. I'm going to stick with that. We're going to call it Secure in Mind, the Mac 2.0. I'm sitting here with a wonderful man who I've met with previously in the beautiful city of Paris. His name is John Denton, John Francis Denton, if I'm not mistaken.
John Wallace Hope Denton.
That's right, John Wallace Hope Denton.
Even more pretentious.
I was trying with my Nicholas Martin Kelly, but you've got me on that. And we are here in Rome in a lovely little room in a hotel. John is shortly about to head off to a lunch and I'm just arrived flustered from Milan because the train was late, sadly. And I'm very fortunate to be sitting here because we are going to be discussing a lot of the things, amazing initiatives that the ICC has been undertaking with John at its helm. And just to remind the viewers the listeners of who you are and what you do, because listeners of the first episode some time ago would have heard that, maybe give us a couple of minutes spiel about who you are and what you're doing, and then we can jump into the current events.
Okay, great, and good to see you, Nick. And we are in a very historic hotel, actually, the Hotel Locarno, just near the Tiber. And it's quite a nice place, I must say. I have a historic room, which is completely dysfunctional for what I need to do while I'm here, which is in the 21st century. Video conferences. I just did a major speech last night to the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development with, 1,000 people from a room without a desk trying to walk around. It's actually hilarious. The world is not built, actually, for the world that we live in now in some respects. So we make do. So I'm the Secretary General of the International Chamber of Commerce. Mm-hmm. The International Chamber of Commerce was founded now more than 100 years ago in Paris by a group of industrialists who took a view that at the end of the First World War, which is the time when we were formed, where governments could not cooperate, but business needed to continue to cooperate and to function, that it was better for them to come together and act where governments couldn't, which mm-hmm. is really the essence of the ICC. Funnily enough, now I know the history a little better. We were actually created as a kind of counterpoint to the League of Nations. That was the idea. So the League of Nations would handle political affairs, and the International Chamber of Commerce would be able to bring together communities and government and business communities globally to look at business affairs. So it's kind of an interesting history. Yeah. And oddly, well, not oddly, just the historical truth, we were founded in the midst of the Spanish flu influenza. And the reason that's relevant is that looking forward to where we are now in the midst of a pandemic, the ICC actually has had a role to play. We have a role. So ultimately, as the Secretary General, I'm responsible for the global ICC. Global ICC, we're in, we have our what's called ICC national committees in more than 110 countries now. In fact, mm-hmm. It's been interesting over the last 18 months. So I've been focused on this issue of what we will be. We've actually expanded. Most recently, just last week, I signed an agreement with all of Francophone Africa's business communities who want to be part of the ICC. We've actually just launched in Central Asia, so Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan. So when I do the final rally counting up, it'll probably be more than 120, 130. And we bring them all together, and we also bring together what's called the World Chambers Federation. That's part of the ICC as well. So in sum, when you look at the ICC, we're effectively in every country in the world representing something like now close to 50 million businesses. But interestingly, those 50 million businesses employ more than 1.3 or 1.4 billion workers, which means that one in three worker in the world relies on the success of the ICC constituent parts for their livelihood. And we take that seriously.
Yep.
And the other perhaps interesting factor, and I'm only giving this to you because I've just been looking at it myself, we are now predominantly comprised of developing business communities in developing and emerging economies.
Mm-hmm.
So 65% of the constituency of ICC is in developing, least developed and emerging economies, which is a very big shift from where we were in at the point of our foundation. Mm-hmm. We were predominantly a Northern Hemisphere group. And that reflected the changes, and what I'm trying to do is reflect that in the ambition of the ICC.
Mm-hmm.
So our ambition, our purpose is to enable business worldwide to secure peace, prosperity, and opportunity for all.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I say worldwide, I can see why those sort of numbers are important.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm effectively saying is we enable business to be a force for good.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that's a really relevant role, particularly for business when in the 21st century we're the big challenge we've got is the lack of ability of governments to cooperate. What we're actually bringing is a functioning private sector globally. And it's a pretty big part of the global world, which we've enabled to function with the commitment to the purpose I just identified.
Okay.
Oh, and I'm the first Australian to run it in more than 100 years, which is an interesting experience.
Which is quite awesome, and we were reflecting about this just before the podcast that there are two Aussies based in Paris who are at the helm of some pretty significant organisations. John is one, and the other is Matthias Cormann heading the OECD. And I guess there are some crossovers there as well.
Absolutely. In fact, if I don't know if you listeners are interested, but the way I see it is, OECD is part of the Bretton Woods sort of consensus. So you have the IMF, the World Bank, the OECD, and the World Trade Organization, mm-hmm. previously called the GATT. I would say the OECD is actually the only functioning part of the, an effective part of the Bretton Woods institution. There's lots of problems at the WTO, as we can talk about later on.
Mm-hmm.
The World Bank has kind of been missing in action in many of the most important discussions that are going on, and there's lots of reasons for that.
Mm-hmm.
The IMF is struggling for relevance at the moment, and you would have seen some of the debates going on
mm-hmm.
about how they can support the global world, how they can support developing and emerging and even middle-income economies during the worst of the pandemic. And that's actually put a lot of pressure on the way the IMF operates. And yet the OECD has been able to pull off this interesting and very important inclusive framework around global tax. And I don't want to get too into the weeds, but we think that is something that should be not just looked at, but kind of thought about how we can use the OECD for other important issues that confront the global world as well. So mm-hmm. this is a business perspective. And that's why I'm so glad that Matthias is there, because Matthias is actually fundamentally a very practical operator. And importantly, he's an outcome guy. Mm-hmm. I suppose I'm an outcome person as well. What I find in these sort of global shows is there's a lot of process people. They're very happy organizing the next meeting or preparing the next joint statement or actually doing a rallying cry for 1,000.
But where are the results?
But where's the output? Where are the outcomes? So let's see if we can bring some Aussie can-do to see if we can actually shift the dial on a few of these things.
Absolutely. G'day, mate. let's pull apart some of the issues that you were inferring are ongoing in the acronyms.
It is a bit of an alphabet soup.
So where do you want to begin? Your WTO,
well,
IMF?
Let's talk a little bit about the WTO. I'm a bit hot to trot on that because I'm also here in Rome. I love Italy. In fact, I was always wondering whether I was secretly born an Italian and no one ever told me. But I'm here actually for the Italy G20 and the Italy B20. So I got a couple more acronyms there. So the Italy has been chairing the G20 this year. The leader is Draghi, and we can come back and talk about how that's going. But importantly, the B20, the Business 20, which feeds directly into the G20, is meeting in Rome for the next day and a bit.
Okay.
And we're bringing our conclusions, which will go forward to the leaders, and then hopefully the conclusions will become part of an action plan out of the G20. But one of the conclusions and one of the areas that I'm focused on particularly is how do we ensure a functioning set of rules and framework to enable global trade to be advanced?
Mm-hmm.
And there's certainly been some really big issues over the last little while. But the fundamental problem is the institution that's supposed to curate that or manage that, which is the World Trade Organization, has effectively fallen into disrepair.
Why?
There's a lot of reasons, and it's a really good why is a good question, because I think you really have to understand what the fundamental problem is before you can design a solution. And I think there's been a lot of talk about solutions without grappling with the fundamental problem. Your listeners may not know this, but I'll just give you a little bit of history on it. The WTO is the successor to what's called the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And it was a point of a view taken that it needed to transform into this World Trade Organization. And negotiation took place in the 90s to enable that to happen. The WTO in its current form has been in existence around 25 years. But if you think about what, if you're interested in comparative history, what else was happening around 25, 26 years ago, in fact, 30 years ago when these negotiations took place? Well, one thing that wasn't happening was the public access or publicly available internet. And so the WTO, which is supposed to, in a sense, curate and enable the global economy and support the operations of the global economy, was designed in a period of time before the internet actually went into public space. And what's really interesting, I don't remember myself, but I don't know if any of your listeners do, that even when the internet went into the public domain, there were no clear payment systems attached to the internet. And so that only came a little bit after. And, of course, the combination of the public domain of the internet with access to payment systems created the opportunity for the e-commerce revolution. And if you think about the component parts of the global economy, I think you'd kind of be missing in action if you didn't realize that the digital economy and what's enabled by it is actually a fundamental part of the 21st century global economy. So you have the WTO, which was designed with rules that were not relevant, that are not relevant, or were just designed without rules relevant to the operation of the of a pretty critical part of the global economy in the 21st century. So that's one problem.
This pretty fundamental problem, fighting for relevance from that.
But in a funny way, I mean, that was all resolvable. If you think what they needed to do was update what's called the rule book about how it operated. But because of the geopolitical dysfunction, they've been unable to do that. The other element was the WTO was founded on two false premises. One was that with opening borders and the, I suppose, the Washington Consensus would mean that global poverty would just decrease and global wealth would increase, which is a fair conclusion. I think economically that can be shown. But the heroic assumption would be was that that would apply to everyone. But it didn't. There are clear winners and clear losers. And, of course, losers blame open trading systems. Losers blame a lot of things, and governments didn't do enough to actually look after losers. They didn't invest in the training, the capability building, the kind of public policy decisions that would ease their way. They chose not to. And, you know, in the end, these are fundamental public policy decisions made by governments. So you're then seeing this kind of citizens revolt in many countries against open trading. You see it in the US, you see it in Europe and others like that. So that's one false assumption. The other was to make this the World Trade Organization, you actually had to bring in systemically important economies. Well, an economy that wasn't in the original General Agreement on Tariff Trade, an economy that was important to bring in was China. Now, if you look at the WTO, the underlying sort of premise of the WTO is that market economies work, and it's designed to support market economies. It's all kind of philosophy around that. So when you bring in or allow or invite China to accede to the WTO, you're expecting them to align their system to support the actual the operating model of the WTO, which is built around a market economy. You also do the same thing with India. You also have a systemically important economy like Brazil and South Africa. So there's a few here. And the idea was that in joining the WTO, they would actually continue to reform their economies to align with the WTO. Well, I think it's fair to say that the expectation versus the delivery is quite different. And so you've now got two false premises which actually underpin one of the challenges we have now with the WTO. The first is there's a lack of public public support and political credibility for the WTO because of the first issue I raised. And the second is that there's a lack of functionality in the WTO. And if you think about it, some of the big issues that emerge for the WTO, putting aside this whole issue of updating their rule book, updating their rule book is fundamental because it goes to making it relevant in the digital age. Mm. But the other area is if you can't resolve some of these issues amongst the members, what they tend to do is kick them upstairs, and they get kicked upstairs to the appellate process, to the judicial process or the arbitral process that supports the WTO, because the members can't decide. So they actually move it along to the judicial process. And you had the people in the appellate process trying to keep the system operating by moving a little bit outside their rails, outside their territory, and starting, in a sense, to make law, which is one of the – you would have heard this in Australia where politicians rail against judge-made law compared to that's our role because we're democratically elected. But in a way, one of the consequences of the dysfunction has been to put that pressure on the appellate process, and they have moved outside their rails. And so you've then got a collapse in support of that as well. So there's a bunch of things going on there. And that I'm just trying to define the problem because you actually have to be honest about how you solve the problem. But there's a reluctance to face up to the fundamental problems we have, but also this design issue. It was designed for a period of time that is no longer there. It was not designed for the 21st century. So we do need to make it relevant. To actually make it relevant, you actually need to update the rules, and you need to actually ensure that there's a functioning sort of curated underlying body to enable the global digital economy, global digital platform to operate.
Has the sense of urgency for reform heightened significantly or recently due to...
Well, no, because in a funny way, this might sound even perverse, politically, you know, governments and politicians sense the wind in their own economies, and they haven't actually put their shoulders to the wheel on reform. And what they've tended to do is kick it down the road, the can down the road again and again and again. And then,
which seems like it's been happening for.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's particulars. Further and better particulars. There's a particular issue that's around the only negotiation taking place in the WTO at the moment, which is relevant to the environment, is called the Fishery Subsidies Agreement. It's been decided for 21 years that agreement should be completed. Well, it hasn't been. That's the kind of level of dysfunction you've got, and dissonance you've got. And leaders at G7, at G20, at APEC, ministerial meetings, they've all said this agreement has to be closed. But then as soon as it goes back into Geneva, the actual ambassadors there and the members there create dysfunctionality because of other things they're playing with, et cetera.
Causing a process swallowed in molasses. Yeah. Right.
And what the politicians try to do, of course, is, you know, with an eye to their own survival, who do they blame for the failure of process, progress? They actually generally blame the Director General. And so that's why I think she's an amazing woman, Dr. Ngozi. Ngozi has taken over. And she's got really constructive, positive, but also a lot of energy if things happen. You know, if things don't move along, you can already see the trade ministers, the political class, seeking to shift the blame onto her. Her ambition was too great. The separation between the secretary and the members, this sort of stuff coming through. But fundamentally, a failure to reform the WTO is the responsibility of the leaders of the countries that are members of the WTO, the trade ministers, and the ambassadors in Geneva. They are the ones who are failing. And we actually have given them roadmaps about how to get out of this. And, you know, I'm in business, so I'm an optimist. We keep on pushing. But the first thing was really to identify what the problem is, and that's what we've been doing, and trying to help people understand that there are better ways forward than ignoring it, that's for sure.
That is a really interesting breakdown. And why don't we move to the next acronym? which one do you want to choose? World Bank or IFC?
Well, I'm sort of maybe in a funny way, I'm not that interested in the World Bank per se, but I'm interested in because if you think about the what comprises the ICC, I'm really interested in the development agenda.
Yep.
And of course, the World Bank should be playing a critical role. And for the purposes of a podcast, I'm being a little bit more aggressive in my language.
All good.
About these groups. But, you know, the World Bank should be playing a more constructive role.
Yeah.
The World Bank should be much more involved in the kind of development process. And on one level, of course, it is. But where are the outcomes? That's the question I always ask. And I do think, and this is why I was keen to do this speech yesterday to UNCTAD. Again, I know that a speech doesn't fix anything. But first of all, the new Secretary General, the woman who runs UNCTAD now, she's relatively new, a woman called Rebecca Grinspan, who I've known for a while. I did it because she invited the private sector in. And what I'm saying is that if you actually want to resolve these development issues, it can't be international organization led. It actually has to be in partnership with the private sector. And it has to be in partnership with the private sector in the regions or the areas that you're working with. Stop telling people what to do. Why don't you work together to find out how you can get it done? And my experience is there's a huge reluctance at the global level for international organizations to actually see the private sector as anything other than a piggy bank that they go to ask for money. They don't actually think and believe that the private sector can have a role in development because they know better. But the fact is, if you look at the track record, and if you're measuring people by success, I think fail is the answer of the inability to recognize that they need to shake things up and do things differently and bring the private sector in for a proper public-private collaboration. And collaboration is where, you know, the collaboration, it always sort of bewilders me how people think collaboration is about being nice to each other. Collaboration is about putting my interests at the same level as your interests and respecting that, which means that we do have different interests. That's okay. I look at things differently. You look at things differently. But if you want to collaborate, understand those interests. And the reason we're collaborating is because we want an outcome. So bring those both things in together. And we've got really good, we've been trialing methodologies to support this in the development space as well.
What types of methodologies?
So a classic is there's a really interesting piece of the WTO, which was called the Global Agreement on Trade Facilitation. And that was designed partly going back to address the one of the false premises that I put up before, which was the lack of equity in the outcomes from open trading barriers and opening trade borders. And it particularly related to developing and least developed countries. So the General Agreement on Trade Facilitation was designed to enable those economies to facilitate basically trade across trade services across their borders. So it's really stuff like customs, how you reform the customs agency so that you can move goods through, phytosanitary, all these sorts of stuff. And so we saw that this is a huge promising area because it can untap, you know, the usual multi billions of dollars of value for these economies like Tanzania, Somalia, sort of stuff. And we think this is a business issue because, you know, the business community's ability to operate across borders is made more inefficient and therefore more costly. And that can actually have a distortion in the way trade operates unless you get this sort of stuff sorted out. And it actually hurts developing economy businesses as well. So we saw the development community were interested in this. We saw individual governments were interested in this. And we know that businesses, from our experience, were definitely interested in this. So the traditional development model would have been to tell governments this is what they need to do. And then, but hold on, how did you work out what was the problem? Are you on the ground? So we said, why don't we look at this differently? Why don't we bring together development agencies, governments, local businesses, and we will effectively moderate or curate the whole show. So we created our own vehicle here, which brings those various parties together. The business communities identify the problems, scope the problems, work with government to actually identify where there needs to be, where the pain points are that they need to work on. And the development agencies then can direct their funding and support to enable capability building. And that's a model of collaboration. And what I'd like to do is scale that model as a development tool, as a development approach.
How quantifiably more efficient is that than previous models?
It's amazing. I mean, you know, sometimes these are not big numbers, but, you know, for small economies and for businesses, they're big numbers. Sometimes it's a $10 million improvement. So on the operation of phytosanitary, we're doing work. I mean, we work in every region on this sort of stuff. We want more projects based on this. But it's really funny. And everyone says this is a great idea, but I just saw, and you would not have read this. I don't say that because I don't I don't expect this, but it's just the reality. Why would you? Guterres was tasked by the membership of the United Nations. He's the Secretary General. Because there's this fundamental issue about the failure of multilateralism and reconceiving it for the 21st century. So they sent him off and his team off to come back with a report to the Security Council and to membership. And he came back about 2 weeks ago with a major speech on multilateralism. And I thought, well, you know, I'm interested in this. In fact, you know, the ICC, because of our size and our scale, you know, we're probably the largest second track process in multilateralism that operates in the world. So I'm very interested in how this works, because effective multilateralism is good for business. And what I just heard, what I discovered was that they've actually done a really good description of the problem, which, by the way, is a real talent of the United Nations. They're very good at admiring problems. But what they haven't done is actually come up with an approach which is effective for the 21st century to resolve the problem. Because what they've done is they've actually conceived of the resolution within their own framework. And their framework from their DNA is really governments, international organizations. And they only have passing reference to working with the private sector. I mean, it's almost sort of like buried under some subparagraph 2.3 somewhere in, you know, under page 160.
That's fascinating that there continue to be binders between those two worlds.
Because fundamentally, a lot of the, and this has been very direct, a lot of the players in the in international organizations fundamentally do not trust the private sector. And so their DNA is, they're just rent seekers, or we just don't like, profit is bad. And so we'll fix this ourselves. And but what they will say, oh, but we did refer to the private sector. And that's how they're coming. So I'm sort of, as you can probably pick up, a little bit hot to trot on this issue.
Understandably
because
so.
If you, but if you think about it, the only functioning part of the global economy is actually the private sector. Because government-to-government relations are not functioning. International organizations have not reinvented themselves to make themselves relevant. A lot of their rule books actually make them look like space junk. And if you don't work with the most functional part, and the private sector, as represented by ICC, we are very happy to work with civil society. In fact, we do. We run campaigns with civil society on issues like debt relief. We work with the international trade union movement on issues which we think are relevant, like vaccine equity. So, hey, guys, wake up. This is not a G77 debate from 1985. We're in the 21st century. The problems of the world need partnerships to resolve them, not the dictation from international organizations and from special interests who actually think only they know the answers. The answers will be resolved through problem solving, bringing different people. And the private sector's got a perfect right to have a voice in that.
That's perfect segue to move to basically probably the last portion of our discussion, which will be ICC and the focus on digitization, the different campaigns you're working on in that umbrella. You and I have spoken about this, and I'm fascinated and a big supporter and a promoter with this podcast as well to some of the initiatives. So I guess finish off with that.
Well, we're super excited around digital opportunities. You know, I was talking to the guy, Wamkile Mene, who runs the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, like basically the director that supports that. And if you look at the future of Africa, I mean, it's written in the terms young and digital. So the two areas, they've got amazing demographics, which should work in their favor, but will really only be untrapped if they can also access a functioning digital economy. And of course, as I said earlier, like the ICC, we are very present in Africa. We're very present in Latin America. We're very present in harder parts of Asia. We're very present in the Middle East. And we know that the future for businesses there and the future of businesses will be comprised of next generation players, not just existing generation players, will require access to a functioning digital platform and functioning and able and a bit being able to be functional and able in digitalized business models as well. But who's helping them? So we see our role. We're governments can't act for the ICC. That's our role. We step up and we try and do it. And so we've been creating various tools and interventions to support it. But again, defining the problem effectively takes us back to where are the common standards that will operate to enable the digital platform. And so we're even working on that. So I created a digital innovation center in Singapore, which is actually, oddly, or maybe many people will, is actually a very good jurisdiction to actually trial new things in the digital world. Mm. So we've been working there. We've actually crowded in WTO, World Customs Organization, a number of other development banks, business, all sorts of stuff. All these people, we've created an advisory board. We've also created a legal advisory board because part of it is also to ensure you've got the standards, but also that the negotiable instruments that are created digitally actually have legal recognition. Mm-hmm. I find this bizarre, but less than 0.1% of bills of lading are actually legally recognizable if they're digital, because governments have not updated their playbooks to recognize the fact that a lot of the global world actually operates digitally now. And so even in a country as sophisticated as Japan, one of the problems they've had during the pandemic has been the close down of activity, because they actually need physical stamps on documents. And if you're in confinement and you've got social distancing, it's very hard to do. And one of the issues in Africa has been the requirement from a lot of customs organizations for what's called wet signatures.
Yeah.
This is not just a developing country problem. This is a global problem. It's actually an issue in the Northern Hemisphere as well.
Yeah.
And so we're looking at creating the standards, legally enforceable, creating the ability, trying to bridge the digital divide, bringing the capability about how you create digital business models and things like that, but being digitized at the same time as going digital. You've got to do more work to do that as well. So we're involved in all those areas. We've launched Centers of Entrepreneurship, which bring that in. We've just launched four in Africa. We're about to launch our first in Latin America. There'll be four or five there this year, including Guatemala, Buenos Aires. Where else are we going to be there? Brazil. How could I forget Brazil? But it's really interesting. These are very well-regarded interventions, because what we also do is, because we're the ICC, we're a not-for-profit, for-purpose organization. Our platforms are all open platform and platforms. So what we're discovering is that there's lots of little independent interventions around things like creating opportunities for entrepreneurship in economies, but they're not linked up. They're actually separate and fractional. So they'll never have the capacity to scale and therefore make a difference. And we saw this most recently. We're launching, the soft launch and building towards a launch in Jakarta of a Center of Entrepreneurship in timing with the handover of the G20 from Italy to Indonesia next year. And we'll launch this with the support of the Indonesian business community in Jakarta. But we did our first soft launch, and we brought together different players, including different ministries and all these sort of people.
Mm.
We discovered, and they discovered, that there are initiatives going on to support entrepreneurship, different initiatives in the same ministry, and they didn't even know.
Mm.
And that's not unusual. That's not an Indonesia problem. Mm. That's a problem in Spain. That's a problem elsewhere.
Mm.
And also there's lots of really interesting NGOs who focus on this area, but they're so proud of what they're doing. They want to be the winners.
Mm.
They don't actually share what they're doing and collaborate across. And so as an open platform, what we're trying to do is create the ability to scale these to make a difference. And the most success we're having, we only launched this 12 months ago, we launched a Center of Entrepreneurship in Beirut.
Mm.
And first of all, because the community had lost complete confidence in government and politics, the only people they trusted was business. And the most trusted business organization is the ICC. They asked us to go in to create a movement around entrepreneurship. And that's because people come and say, the answer is get a job, but there are no jobs. So how do we help people create their own livelihood? And that's the purpose of the Centers of Entrepreneurship. It's linked, obviously, with digital, linked with inclusion. It's linked with all the startups, linked with all those elements you'd expect.
I was fortunate enough to be invited
to the Africa one. Yeah.
To the Africa one and discuss cybersecurity. And it just made me think the interaction between centers of entrepreneurship and an accelerator and incubation hubs, like, for example, in Australia, and I'm speaking with him last week, the former CEO of Stone and Chalk, which is the fintech accelerator, which then acquired AusCyber, which is the Australian vessel for building cyber. And a lot of that is focused on developing jobs in a marketplace, in Oz at least. Is that the idea as well with centers?
Yeah, well, we actually have joined up with a group called we've got to go. We've joined up with a group called Mind. It's a global startup play, which was actually a very effective startup play in Italy. And they wanted to go global, and so we became their partner. We've taken the startup awards that they do globally. We actually got, what we're doing is linking up procurement chains and large multinationals who invest in the next stage. And that becomes part of our play as well. So, yeah, it's all there. Yeah.
Well, John, we've been told that the time is...
My minder has told me to move.
It's been an absolute pleasure as always, and I look forward to grabbing a coffee in Paris.
Could you better than that?
See you soon.
See ya.
Thanks, bye-bye.
The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy, because being human is the common denominator for us all.